Welcome to Better Words, a podcast for readers who want to know the stories behind the pages.
We're your hosts, Caitlin and Michelle, two book nerds who bring you in-depth conversations about writing and publishing from those on the inside.
Basically, we're just here to talk about books.
We're so glad you're joining us.
Hello, welcome back to Better Words.
It's a brand new season.
How exciting for us and you.
Hopefully. I know, it's strange. I almost didn't say, oh, it's a brand new season, because of course we released our first reread episode with Libby Page last week. So it was kind of like a 0.5 or something. Like we sort of started and sort of didn't, but we're here now.
This is our first intro thing that we've recorded. Caitlin is coming to you from her office. That's why she sounds a little bit different, but just because we just had some logistical things this week.
Yeah, timing things. So yeah, recording from a meeting room in my office with my work headphones. So yeah, just different mic, different headphones. Makes all the difference. Hopefully I don't sound too different. That's a bit weird, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I think it's mostly the same. Yeah, so these are we try to catch up with what we've been reading and stuff. But before we share recommendations, Caitlin, I wanted to chat to you about rereading, because obviously it's something I've been trying to do a lot more.
Yes.
And mostly very successfully, I would say. I've really enjoyed the books that I've been rereading. But over our break, I reread something that I used to love, and we did it for our book club, and I do not love it anymore.
Oh, no.
I know. But I still think it's really important to, revisit books and maybe, look at the ways in which they might be a little bit more problematic than you thought they were. And
yeah,
just and sort time of also can change look at how a lot changed. Of things.
Yeah, we have said this before about reading YA. Now that we're not young adults anymore. We're just full on adults, and we still love YA. But there are sometimes we don't relate to that teenage experience anymore, and so revisiting, teen favorites or childhood favorites can be risky in that way, because, a lot has changed in the world in many, many years, and we've changed a lot, so it can be really different.
Yeah, and similarly to my experience rereading Brooklyn last year, where I was oh my God, Caitlin, these are the books I love now, where not much happens, and, I flew through it this time.
Yeah, you actually liked it more.
Yeah, because I had grown as a reader. The same is true, obviously, for books that maybe you used to love that you read now and think, actually, I probably wouldn't enjoy this, or I wouldn't. Yeah, there are certain authors I used to really love who I haven't read for years, and it's sort of almost I've just outgrown them a bit. I had that phase of enjoying them, and it's maybe just not to my taste anymore. But I sort of think sometimes we don't kind of talk about that enough in kind of the bookish world, because often, and we're part of this too, we're so focused on new releases and reading new things and meeting reading goals, and what can we consume new but actually,
and it's such a time obviously our taste change task to read a book,
yeah,
that in comparison to say TV shows or movies or music and stuff like that, it's easier to maybe go back to old favorites and reanalyze them more frequently, or enjoy them again, or yeah, that kind of thing. Because it's, in comparison, TV shows can be very long, obviously, but a movie that, maybe at most could be 3 hours long, it takes more than twice that to read most books.
Exactly. Yeah. And also, obviously, we're so focused on what's coming up next, what new things are we going to read, that we don't often reread, which is something we've talked about before, of something I know you said you wanted to try and reread a bit more this year. But yeah, I guess I wanted to be I think because it could have been like one of the last episodes where I was like, oh my gosh, loved Brooklyn even more. It was amazing. And now I'm like, actually in my reread experiment, I have at least one book that I didn't like the second time around and I have a lot of issues with.
So, yeah. And on our reread experiment, I have not reread a single book yet. So maybe I should try and do that soon.
Well, that's only I've reread two books this year, and one of them was Avari McFarlane, and of course I loved it. That is not what I'm talking about. And then the second one, I don't know whether I want to say it or not, but I've
Can
talked about it on the
me?
Podcast before.
Tell me.
No, that's not fair. It's okay. It is I'll Be Gone in the Dark by Michelle McNamara, which you know I've recommended
really?
Before. Mm-hmm.
Oh my god, this makes this so much more fascinating to me, actually. Because why? I mean, nonfiction maybe is even more in a point in time, and that book, I know from you talking about it, has complicated things in that it was finished after she had died. So like,
that's
is that
reason.
Part of it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
Rereading it, that it felt really disjointed. And I think maybe but the big discussion, it was a fascinating discussion actually in book club. I just really appreciate the conversations we have in book club because the women I do it with are just also amazing individually. I talk to them on WhatsApp and I have like a big WhatsApp chat with them. And they all just have such cool experiences and it's really fascinating to hear their viewpoints. And even though often we end up maybe not liking the book or I guess other people bring up things that I hadn't noticed and it makes me maybe dislike the book. I really appreciate that as a reading experience. Like I think that is the value of book clubs and sharing books with other people.
To go very in depth and break it apart.
Yeah. And the general feeling was that she probably wouldn't have got a book deal based on what she did were it not for who her husband was. But also that because she died when she did, they sort of maybe rushed publication a bit and it does feel really disjointed. And then we were like, is it fair, you know, if you were a writer and had been really working on something for so long, would you be happy that it was published no matter what? Or would you be annoyed that it was published maybe not in the format that you had wanted? And I think that's just a really interesting discussion, isn't it, to think that like, would you prefer a half finished format of anything, or would that upset you that it's like your first draft pretty much? And I think on reading it the second time, it felt more like a first draft, and it was a bit confusing in places, and there were places where her writing is really great, but I think overall it felt like it needed a really good like structural edit. Like it felt like coming in before the editing process was finished a bit this time around. And maybe that's to do more with my experience as well of long projects and stuff, but the timeline and stuff jumped all over the place. And it's so weird, isn't it, when you like used to like a book and
Yeah, but yeah, and to have, because you read that when it first came out, so to have more distance from that story as a whole, it's a pretty unique publishing story. So even, you know, the content of the book aside, almost to have a bit more distance from that and reevaluate how you feel about it is different as well.
Yeah,
100%. Fascinating.
That aside, do you have any updates before you share your recommendations, any bookish updates? You've gone to lots of events lately. How was Rebecca Kwang at the Sydney Opera House?
Yeah, it was awesome. I did get sunburnt sitting outside having lunch beforehand, my own fault. And anyone else who was there will know it was actually really hot that day and I just was not prepared. But it was a really fascinating discussion. She is so intelligent and speaks so well and had all these like, every kind of complicated question she launched into an amazing explanation. So I was like, was this whole interview like pre-written? Like it's crazy. She Yeah, she speaks much better than I do as I'm trying to explain this. And yeah, it was really, I went with quite a few friends and we were all just in awe of her, found her so impressive. And I know that by the time this goes out, obviously her other events in Brisbane and in Melbourne will have already happened. So a lot of people have heard her speak now in Australia, which is very exciting. And while Rebecca is a HarperCollins author, I did pay for my ticket. So just to clarify that. Not that bias.
I just think it's amazing too. Like, it's obviously so hard to get to Australia. It's expensive. Mm. So it's wonderful when an author like that is able to come and do speaking tours in Australia.
Yeah, it was a wonderful
and
little
also
tour.
Then, yeah, have such a great response because I saw not just from you but like from other people who went to the Sydney event just talking about how amazing she was. So it just sounded like such an incredible event. And yeah
she's, it was amazing.
I mean, the Poppy Wars series isn't necessarily something I'm into, but I really need to read Babel and I'm just really curious to see what she writes next.
Yeah, her next book is I believe it's going to be a standalone, but it is fantasy. But it's probably not coming out until next year, I don't think. I don't think it's scheduled for this year. So, yeah, it's very exciting. And the program for the Sydney Writers Festival has gone live in the last week or so. So I've bought a bunch of tickets for that. So I'll be there at the end of May.
Can you share some what
every
events
year.
You're going to?
So I always like going to all the YA events that they have during the day. Yes, and there was a panel, they do a Queer Stories like gala speaking event on the Friday, which I'm going to go to. There's a panel that features three people who've published memoirs about their families, and it's called Dirty Laundry, and about like airing your dirty laundry, which sounds fascinating, so I'm going to that. What else did I book? Oh, Anne Patchett is doing an In Conversation with Meg Mason, and I bought a ticket for that.
Amazing.
There
is that
so
a live
many
one?
Excellent...
Like, is she coming to the festival?
Yeah, she's coming.
Or is it video?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, no, it'll awesome. Be here, which is amazing. And there was Bonnie Garmus, who wrote Lessons in Chemistry, is also doing events. I haven't checked. They possibly are already sold out, but they actually clashed with other things that I wanted to go to, so I'm not going to see her speak when I would have liked to. But... Yeah. You can only pick so many things, you know. It was getting out of hand.
So hard, yeah.
I've booked many events.
Amazing. Oh, wow. That sounds so fun. I can't wait to hear all about that as well. Shall we share some recommendations?
Would you like to go first? What did you read on your weekend away?
I can go first. yes. Yeah, so I devoured this book on our weekend away in Wales. So side note, we went to Wales for my husband Jack doing like a... It was like a timed event, not a race, a timed event, mountain bike competition, because they have some amazing mountain biking in Wales, in North Wales in particular. And he's been looking forward to that for ages. Had a really bad sprained ankle in January from climbing, where he fell off the climbing wall, and worked really hard to rehab that. And then was much better and then has had a really bad cold all week. And I mean, like, hideous cough. Like, it's getting on my nerves, cough.
Oh, no.
It's so horrible, isn't it? Because you don't want to be angry at someone because they're sick, but also every time he coughs, I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's had such a bad cough, poor thing. So, yeah, he was feeling really rubbish. And I was like, well, it's too late now. You're doing it. so, yeah, anyway, he was fine. And actually, miraculously, for this time of year and for Wales, it didn't rain. He had all his wet weather stuff sort of prepared and it did not rain. It was really nice weather for the trip, but it was kind of fun for me because we took Percy. I took him for a little walk at the centre because there's some walking trails and then they also had like a cafe. And so then I just sat where the room was full of other women who were obviously waiting for men. And like, I'm not trying to be sexist, but that's what it was. It was women and children. There were a couple of women who did the course, but it was an overwhelmingly male event. But, and it's so funny because, like, they all just kind of looked the same, like, with all their gear on. Like, it was just really, you know, you were like, oh, yeah, you're a mountain biker. Like,
there's
it's
a
funny.
Type
like, sometimes,
who would do this.
Yeah. And, like, to be fair, like, sometimes I walk into our climbing gym and I'm like, yeah, you can tell everyone here is a climber. Like, it just, I don't know, it's the clothes. It's, it's a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a whole vibe, right? I mean, it's the same when you walk into, like, a pole class or something, or, like, an aerial class, and you're like, you know, the people who are wearing, like, the pleaser shoes and stuff like that, and you're like, ah, yes, I know. Like, I don't know. There's just something about it. It's where they get their stuff from. I don't know. Anyway, so I was there with a lot of other women and had a lovely coffee, and then I just sat purse in my lap because it was the only way he would settle down, and read my book for, like, 2 hours, and it was great. It was so good. So, yeah, the book that I was reading was called Everyone on This Train is a Suspect, and it's by Benjamin Stevenson, and I was just racing through it on the weekend. It was so good. It is the sequel to Everyone in My Family Has Killed Someone. Do you remember this, Caitlin? You haven't read it.
Yes, I do. I'm familiar with the series. It's just, I haven't read it, but, you know,
you need
I've seen
to.
It around.
I think you would enjoy this because it's similar sort of vibes to Janice Hallett. So in terms of, like, a mystery series, I think you would enjoy this. It's very, very clever. It's so smart because it's like that, like, fiction written as, like, memoir sort of thing. And so the first one is a memoir. In the second one, the main character, Ernest, is at a writer's festival after publishing his memoir, Everyone in My Family Has Killed Someone. So it all, like, that's very clever.
Oh,
and
that's
honestly,
quite fun.
It's a great sequel in that you really don't, it's been ages since I read Everyone in My Family Has Killed Someone. I think as well with mysteries in particular, you tend to forget all the little nuanced details. It's a great sequel in that I don't really think you need to have read the first one to enjoy this one and enjoy the vibe of it. And because of the way it's done as this was the book that he wrote, I think you could get away with reading this one first. And then if you like going back to the other one, because it's the way,
like,
it's
to get the extra info. Yeah. That'd be kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really clever. So it's set on the Ghan, which is the train that goes from Adelaide to Darwin in Australia, which I've been on. So that was cool.
Have you?
And basically,
that's cool. I want to go on that.
My dad and I went, it was really cool. So he is invited. They're basically doing a literary festival on the train, and it's all mystery writers because it's by the Australian Mystery Writers Society. So they've got a bunch of writers on the train who all know how to get away with murder because that's what they have. And the funny thing is I recommended in our newsletter the podcast The Rest is Entertainment with Richard Osman and Marina Hyde. And I know I keep bringing it up because he always has such fascinating insights, but someone asked the question in their Q&A, Richard, do you think you could plan the perfect murder? And he was like, the funny thing about mystery writers is that you spend your whole time planning the perfect murder because you need to know how to plan the perfect murder so that you can then solve the murder. And that is literally what mystery writers do. So it is true that mystery writers themselves think like this. And so it's a royalty of crime writers. But one of them is murdered. So then the rest of them start honing their quote-unquote expertise to try and figure it out. And basically the blurb says, together we should know how to solve a crime or commit one. Dun, dun, dun. It's really fun. Yeah, it's so fun. And the whole kind of thing with both these books is that Ernest is it's such an ironic name because, like, he's very earnestly like, look, these are the rules for detective fiction that mean that it's like fair play mysteries, that you can solve this as I write the mystery down. And he keeps stopping and he'll be like, I'm going to use the killer's name like 106 times. And then he'll stop throughout and be like, this is a tally of where we're at on names if you want to try and solve this thing. And remember, like, we're talking aliases here too. And he, like, gives you all these little clues. And, like, right before he reveals who the killer is, he's like, okay, this is your last chance. Here's a list of the number of times I've mentioned people's names. Yeah. Yeah, it's so clever. And like, I mean, I love books that have that like fourth wall break. I think we've said this before, we don't know what to call it in books, but you know what I mean. And it's just so clever because he's there being like, I don't know what the idea for my second book is going to be. And I'm telling all these people that, I just got like lucky a bit because there was a serial killer on this mountain that I was stuck on with my family. And so, that's how I wrote the first book. And now I need to come up with this idea. And he's sort of like sharing it all with you. And oh, it's just so clever and funny. And
What an
yeah, I read it
interesting
in like 2 days.
structure.
Yeah, it's so
Oh,
clever.
great.
And the structure of this is really interesting as well because it's broken up into different parts based on the type of books that people write. So there's like memoir, legal thrillers, police procedural. There's like the blockbuster crime ones and the
Oh,
like
that's so
forensic,
fun. That
psychological. It's
reminds
so
me
clever.
of this.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's there's a Apple TV original series that I watched. I watched the first season. There is a second season which I haven't seen, but the first season was all these people who go to their high school reunion and someone ends up dead. So then when a police woman is interviewing them and they recount the night, it's in like their episode is in different genres. So like one guy
Oh,
who wanted
that's
to go to the
cool.
reunion to like talk to this girl he liked in high school, his is like a rom-com. And then there's like this one guy and his episode is like a spy thriller, like an action movie, like he's Jason Bourne or something. Like it's really funny. So that sounds a bit like that's a really
What
fun
show is that?
structure.
Because
It's called The
that
After
sounds really cool.
Party.
Okay, I'm gonna check that out.
Yeah,
That
'cause it's the
sounds really
after
cool.
party of the reunion. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, awesome. That sounds so interesting. Yeah, so I really, really loved this book. Just such a solid follow-on. It's one of those mysteries that, yeah, you just get swept up in. It's super enjoyable, but you also feel like you're in on the joke and you feel like you're part. I don't know. It's just really, really fun. And as I said, the great thing about this is you do not need to have read the first one. Okay, your turn,
My
Caitlin.
yes,
I've talked enough.
my recommendation is a book that I borrowed from the library, Cherry Beach by Laura McPhee Brown. It was published by Text a couple of years ago, but I actually picked this up at the library when I went, and they had this whole amazing Valentine's themed Library Lovers Month promotion thing going, and they had a bunch of books wrapped blind date with the book. So I picked
Oh,
it up
cool.
because it said. I'll read you. It said, "Pick me if you love coming into identity, complex relationships, queer romance."
Amazing.
So
Sounds great.
obviously, I picked it up. so this book follows two best friends, Hetty and Ness, who are like born and raised in Melbourne and moved to Toronto in Canada for like a gap year kind of vibe. So they're there, they're exploring together, they move into a share house and make friends and get their own jobs. And as Ness like is figuring out, everything starts to kind of fall into place for her. She's like made a couple good friends and has a job she likes and starts like a fun relationship with someone that she meets at a gallery and all these kind of fun things. Hetty, who is normally more outgoing and the like, from the whole book is from Ness's perspective, and so Hetty is this, she's the pretty one, she's the smart one, she's the one that like everyone liked at school, and she's taller and beautiful and so outgoing and everyone always loves Hetty. And yeah, and like she gets a job and makes new friends and everything as well, but kind of falls into this, into like a lot of different bad decisions and people who aren't a very good influence on her and everything. So it's this really interesting coming of age story with two friends who have been like childhood best friends and friends their whole lives as they're actually maybe growing apart a little bit, but they don't really want to. And what will this like year in Toronto do to them and to their relationship? It's, I think one of the quotes on the front says it's like heart-wrenching and tender or something, and it's absolutely is. It's not very long, but it feels a little bit slow, but it's like beautiful, and you're just kind of with the characters going through this story. And I actually, it took me a little while to read, maybe because I was, it's just not a very fast-paced read in like a good way. Like it's, you savor it and it's beautifully written. But some books like that where you're like, this is so beautiful, but you're just like, oh my God, the pages are taking me longer to read than I think they should in some kind of way. But I took the ferry to and from Circular Quay for the Rebecca Kuang event. And so I read like the whole second half of it on the ferry on Sunday. Just like sitting, listening to the water, trying to block out all of the other people around me on the ferry. And it was actually quite lovely.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Forever grateful for both of us that we can read while moving
Oh,
somehow,
yeah,
whether that be in the
absolutely.
car for me or, the boat for you. Because, yeah, I read a lot on our, like, the times that I wasn't driving when we drove to Wales. So, yeah, it's the best.
Yeah, 100%. I'm so glad I can read on transport for sure. Yeah, and love, like I'd seen this book around, and I had kind of never picked it up at the time, and probably would have been one that I maybe didn't go back to unless someone specifically recommended it to me, or maybe, if this author like had another book that I then read and kind of went back or something, But yeah, blind date with a book at the library. I even didn't like unwrap it before borrowing it. Like I borrowed it like covered up.
Awesome.
And I loved
That's so
that. I
cool.
was like, I'm so into my library at the moment, Go to the library.
Yeah, go to the library. That's wonderful. Yay. Well, yeah, without further ado, we will get on to our first new author interview of the year then. And it is, we're kicking off with YA, but don't get too excited if you enjoy YA because we actually don't have much YA coming up.
No, this might be the only one that we've
Might be
sort
the
of
only
planned
one.
so far. So the only one for a
Yeah.
while, but this is a really, really special YA book.
Our guest today is a young adult author whose first novel, Flying Tips for Flightless Birds, won the CBI Book of the Year, the NI Book Award, and was nominated for the Carnegie Medal. When not riding, she can be found exploring in an unreliable VW camper van and running a creative writing club for teen writers. Today, we are discussing her second novel, Little Bang. Welcome to the podcast, Kelly McCrochrane.
Thanks so much for joining us. I feel like Little Bang might be the meatiest YA book I've read in a while. And it's not long. There's just so much in it and so much that we want to talk to you about. But probably the best place to start is if you just tell us a little bit about Little Bang, even though hopefully our regular listeners will remember from the end of last year when Michelle recommended it.
Oh, I like the meaty. That's a good description. I want that on the cover.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a YA romance, and there's a lot of humor in it. It's about a pair of quite mismatched teenagers who get pregnant on their first date. But the complication is that they live in Northern Ireland in 2018, where abortion is still illegal. And everyone they turn to for help has their own agenda and their own opinions about what they should do. Abortion being one of those things that people are very opinionated about. Mel is a shy science geek, and she's kind of sick of being the good girl in her religious family. So she agrees to go out with Sid, and he's the school bad boy, and he kind of gives her the courage to be a bit of a rebel. But Sid is always in trouble, but Mel makes him feel like there could be more to him than everyone thinks. So they're kind of perfect for each other in a way. But when they get pregnant on their first date, the relationship just starts to crack under all the pressure, and they quickly find out that pregnancy is a very different experience for boys and girls, especially when everyone finds out about it. And they have to grow up very fast to try and hold on to each other and to the futures that they'd planned for themselves.
Amazing. Perfect description, of course. I can tell that you've honed that one. But I think actually I did not write this down as a question. But I, especially like as an adult reading YA, I was so impressed that, like, the thing that I just kept thinking is the discussions that they were having about the inequality of pregnancy for men and women and what it means for both their futures is still so relevant to a woman who is nearly 30 and having these discussions with my friends who are nearly 30 about, do we want to have kids? Yes, but when and what does this mean and what are we scared about? And actually, there was a great podcast that Caitlin and I both listened to called Shameless, and they were talking about this fact that the thing that still scares them, I think they were talking about it in relation to Tommy Fury and Molly Mae Hague, that the thing that still scares them is that it still does fall on the woman so often to be the one who physically has to be there and often emotionally takes on that role as well, even if the men are quite well intentioned. And I would say Sid, bless him, is very well intentioned in a lot of this, and he does try and he does step up to the plate, but the reactions from people are so different. And I just, as I said, like, as adults who read YA, I think both of us were so impressed by that without it feeling like too, I mean, it's still read really wonderfully for teens, but I just was like, oh my gosh, how have you nailed, like, exactly what we are in our late 20s still working out? It was just, that was my favorite thing of the book. And I was like amazed that a book for teens could still have me thinking all those things and be like mulling all that over and mirror the conversations that are so frequent when you get to this age with your friends, I think.
Yeah, but I guess that, you know, that gender gap, it starts in the pregnancy, but it goes on throughout your whole life then, because it's, you know, it's not just the pregnancy, it's the childcare and everything as well. And I mean, the book kind of, I mean, I knew that was the case before I started writing it, but in the writing of it, I realized just how much it was the case, you know. I mean, right from the start, Sid is treated like he's done something stupid, while Mel is treated like she's done something wrong. You know, there's like a moral judgment on her. And then Sid is praised for stepping up and sticking by her, as if that's not like the very least he should do. While Mel just gets humiliated at school, she has a much worse time. And she becomes quite aware of just how different parenthood would be for them and how much freer Sid is to just walk away. Even though he doesn't. But I mean, in the writing of it, because it's written as a dual narrative, so there's a, you know, Mel's point of view and Sid's point of view. And doing that made it even clearer to me how much Mel's world narrows while Sid's expands in the wake of the pregnancy. I mean, I was writing, you know, each chapter from a different point of view. And it got to the point where I was like, there's much more happening in Sid's chapters. You know, they seem more interesting. There's more going on. His chapters are longer. Why is that? And I was trying to balance them. And then I realized, well, no, they wouldn't be balanced. Because he's left school. He's getting different jobs. He's meeting new people. He starts doing gigs. He's got all this stuff going on because his world just expands. While hers narrows to really sitting in the house worrying and reading baby books and trying to get ahead on her schoolwork and just having interactions with her family. And her world suddenly becomes very internal and she's just thinking a lot while his is about going out there and doing stuff. And so in the end, I didn't try to balance them because I thought, no, this is the difference and that's important.
Yeah. Mm. And even with both of them being so well-intentioned, you're right. Sid is trying to step up so he gets all these jobs and meets all these new people and is trying to make something of himself to provide. Meanwhile, Mel being the one who is physically pregnant, she feels sick and so she's at home and her friends don't get it and her family it's so fascinating. But yeah, this book, as you said, is written from both their perspectives. Was that always going to be the case, or did you end up splitting it, apart from maybe there being more going on for Sid? Did you find one of them easier to write for?
I don't know. I don't remember making the decision. It just kind of happened naturally. I guess I was just interested in how it affected both of them. And because they're such different people and they come from such different backgrounds, and those backgrounds kind of allowed me to, you know, represent the different arguments in the abortion debate. You know, having those characters interact and clash. Mel's family is very conservative and religious, and Sid's mum, she's a single mum and she's a very,
I love her so much.
I love her too.
Love her so much. She's great. Best.
She's a very strident and outspoken feminist. And so when they clash, you know, it gives you a chance to explore, you know, those different sides of the abortion debate, which was really fun to write, and a way of getting those issues on the page without it just being a lecture. Because I think it also humanizes those sides of the debate, because I think that's the strength of a novel. You know, you're not writing an essay about abstract concepts or theories. These are people, and they're just flawed. They're not perfect. They don't always behave well. But you know, they believe what they believe, and they have their reasons for believing what they believe. They're coming from very different places. They have very different life experiences. And I think when you read about people like that in a novel, you're forced to get inside their head and see why they are the way they are. And it's much harder to just dismiss a person and their beliefs when you've got inside their head and you see where they're coming from. And you know, you realize that they're just people who care about their kids. They care about something the same as you do. They're just maybe coming from a very different place than you are, but you're kind of forced to treat them as a human being, not just an argument. So, you know, I like doing that with the characters. So having Mel and Sid come from such different backgrounds allowed me to do that. So I guess I wanted to include both their worlds, and that meant including both their point of views.
And including a lot of both their parents as well, actually, while we're sort of on that, talking about Sid's mum and their families and everything. There is quite a bit from like the people around them in their lives as well, like Sid's mum, obviously. But then, again, because it's such a complex issue, there's also Mel's sister, who's been trying for a few years. And that is a very complex part of this story for Mel and how she feels about everything.
Yeah, again, you know, everybody comes to the abortion debate with their own life experience, and that life experience can be something very emotional, which just heightens the argument. You know, I think that's why it can be such a heated and sometimes ugly debate, because people are bringing their
own... such a complex issue.
Yeah, their own stuff to it. Yeah. And one of the characters mentions that, you know, Mrs. Edgar, she says, you have to remember you're not arguing with people's heads, you're arguing with their hearts and where they've come from and what they've been through. And yeah, you know, Mel's sister is having fertility issues, so of course this is going to be an emotional thing for her. And then Sid's mum, Lucille, she had an unplanned pregnancy when she was really young, and she was not keen on being a mum, and kind of got railroaded into it. So her life experience is, you know, informing her opinions. So again, everybody comes to it with their own stuff, but at the end of the day, this is Mel and Sid's decision, and it's very hard for them to kind of realise that they're, you know, getting everyone to agree with them is not the point. They just have to figure out what's right for them and let everybody else believe what they believe.
Yeah, and I really empathise with Mel, especially her sort of just wanting someone to make the decision for her. Like, when something is so big and overwhelming, you do want that. But we see her struggle with knowing that that actually might not be the best for her personally. And obviously the whole book is that journey for her, and that journey to a decision that she wants to make. And you still surprise me with lots of stuff of where things were going to go, and I really appreciated that. I know we've skipped straight into talking about the book, but I'm curious, like, did this come to you as a novel idea from one thing, or was it an accumulation of things that you thought, yeah, actually this will be perfect for my next novel?
Yeah, I mean, where the book came from was basically in 2018 Ireland held a referendum on their abortion laws, because abortion was illegal down there too. And I live in Northern Ireland, so I wasn't eligible to vote in that referendum. And I remember feeling relieved that I wasn't allowed to vote, because I knew so little about the subject that I didn't think I'd feel comfortable voting. And then I thought, like, isn't that a bit mad? Like, why do I not know anything about this? You know, surely a young woman, I should know a fair bit about this. That's a bit crazy. And that just made me really uncomfortable. But like, it wasn't surprising at all that I didn't know anything about it, because it is not talked about here. It was never mentioned in school, certainly wasn't part of our sex education. And it's just it was illegal here too. So, you know, it's just one of those things that's whispered about everywhere, but nobody really talks about it. And certainly nobody educates young people about it. So I mean, probably most of the people in this country didn't know much about it. But that made me really uncomfortable.
I think same where we grew up, like, we didn't,
yeah,
I don't think that we learned about that really, like, as an act, because it was illegal in the state where we grew
all
up
over. Until, it's still a very
is it still illegal in such New a South tricky Wales, or
I don't know. Isn't that terrible?
This is the thing.
I think it is.
Yeah, it's you amazing. Suddenly think like this is crazy.
Yeah, and I didn't know that about Australia. And yeah, people don't know their own laws. This was one of the things I discovered because, you know, I set out to educate myself about it and I read as much as I could. And the more I learned, just the angrier I got just about how little I had known and my friends had known when we were young about all this big stuff that might actually at that time in your life have had an enormous impact on your future. And I, you know, I got chills thinking about how vulnerable I had been as a 16-year-old girl, you know, embarking on my first relationships, knowing practically nothing about anything. But yeah, one of the things I realized was that nobody understands their own abortion laws. And, you know, people in England and Wales and Scotland are often quite surprised when you tell them that abortion has never been decriminalised in England, Wales or Scotland. It's been decriminalised in Northern Ireland since 2019, which makes we're in a better position actually than the rest of the UK. In the rest of the UK, it's still under criminal law. Like the 1967 Abortion Act provides a legal defence for doctors who perform abortions under certain conditions, but it remains a criminal offence and people are still put on trial for managing their own abortions. And it's still tied up with, you know, shame and judgment and criminal law rather than just being part of ordinary healthcare. And people don't even realise that. And that's quite a dangerous position, I think, because, you know, it's when you start taking those laws for granted that they can be pushed back. And that's exactly what happened in America. And, you know, people assume that that couldn't happen here, and it absolutely could. And especially in Northern Ireland, because, I mean, there's the reason we got equal marriage and decriminalisation of abortion was because Westminster forced those laws on us. Our government did not choose them. And if it had been up to our government, I don't think we would have them yet. So there's still people very high up in our government who would quite happily roll back that progress. So I think even though the danger now that it's decriminalised is that people kind of go, oh, well, that's done and dusted. We don't need to worry about that anymore. You know, we just start to take it for granted. Mm. But that's when you can get pushed back. So I think it's important that we keep...
Can always be taken away.
Exactly,
as we've seen in the US, as you said.
It's important that we keep talking about it. I went and, you know, found out about it for myself because I felt so strange about the fact that I wouldn't have known how to vote in that referendum. And I thought, you know, if Northern Ireland had a referendum, I wouldn't feel comfortable voting. So I'd gone and read all about it. And the thing was, when I looked into how sex education is done in schools now, I was quite shocked to discover that it hasn't really changed very much. You know, young adult writers quite often want to write the book that wasn't there for them when they were young. But often when they go and look into it, they realise that book's not needed anymore because things have progressed and, you know, thankfully things have moved on. But actually in this case, it felt like nothing had changed and young people were still being sent out there completely unarmed. And I just thought that was ridiculous. And I wish there'd been a book like this there when I was young. And there still wasn't anything for young people today, certainly nothing set in Northern Ireland with our particular political background and cultural background. So I just wanted something like that to exist.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I feel like, you know, I was so uninformed about abortion as well. Like, I feel like maybe the movie Juno was the most that I got discussions about teen pregnancy. Like, it's so strange, isn't it, that hasn't changed that much.
But this is the thing with YA, where, as you said, people like write the YA book that they didn't have and everything, and so there is that view that young adult contemporary fiction, maybe particularly, is so progressive. You know, there's so many amazing queer stories and like all of these things, which is incredible. But I can only think of one other book, YA book, that I've ever read where a character is pregnant, and it was not as good as yours. The author's pushy, like, agenda was quite clear throughout. Similarly, what would have been over a year ago, a couple years ago, we interviewed an Australian author whose YA book, it was like an older YA book, so the characters were like 18, 19, but it was about an arranged marriage. And so some of these things where it's like, these are things that young adults do experience, and none of the books are about those things.
They might not actually become pregnant as teenagers, but as I said before, the conversations that are had in this book around the responsibilities and stuff will still be so relevant for those young adults who maybe read this at 17, but then, you know, in their 20s get pregnant. Like, it's still so relevant if you are a younger mother, which is still relevant if you're whatever age. But, you know, like I know a lot of people, you know, my sister-in-law included, who, you know, had babies in their early 20s and stuff. And that is still going to be a really relevant decision, especially so like at the start of your career where you don't have that safety net of maybe you've been in a career for ages and you have good maternity leave or whatever. Not that I have any of that, but it's something that's been on my mind of like, and I've had other women I know, other colleagues who say, well, like, I don't want to leave this job because we might have a baby and I want the maternity. Like that is, it is something that you think about more, I guess, the longer you've been in a career or a job. And so I think, yeah, especially like early on, those discussions are still so relevant. And I just think, again, if you choose to do it, like it's so great to be informed of that and not, I guess like Lucille was sort of talking about in the book, making that decision, still not regretting your child, but being like, whoa, there's a lot of stuff I didn't think about and what that would mean for my future. Those discussions as well, and I've, you know, heard this discussed on podcast as well about, you know, women my age, it's so hard to have those discussions with people who have already had children, because of course, like, most people love their children and they probably would not change that decision for the world. So it's difficult to have those discussions without, again, bringing the baggage and being like, well, I don't want to say that I regret my children, but could things have been different, for example? So it's great to read about it in fiction where it's not as quite as personal for people.
There ended up being so many other issues in the book. You know, I thought the book was just going to be about a pregnancy. But of course, the reason people have strong opinions about abortion is that it's tied up with all those other things. So it ended up being, you know, about motherhood and bodily autonomy and religion and sex and double standards for boys and girls and the realities of parenthood and RSE in schools, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And this was all, it all seemed like big stuff that could really impact a young person's life and that they were going to face at some point, and yet nobody talks to them about it. I mean, even the choice to not have children at all, no one ever kind of sits them down and says, you know, that's an option and you would be perfectly fine, you'd be perfectly happy, it's okay to do that. Nobody tells you that, and that was something that I worried about as a young person. I kind of looked around me and thought, everybody's having kids, so obviously that's the thing you're supposed to do, and you could never regret it because nobody ever says they regret it. So probably it's probably the safer choice, whereas you hear about people who haven't had kids who, you know, are, you know, torn apart by that. But the difference is that they wanted to have kids and didn't. And nobody ever said, you know, if you just choose not to and then don't have them, you'll be absolutely fine and happy. And as soon as someone did say that to me, I actually read it in a study someone had done about women who'd had children and women who hadn't. And the ones who hadn't, who just made the decision not to have them and then didn't have them, were just as happy as people who'd had them. And it was like just a weight fell off my shoulders. I just went, oh, okay, so that is okay. Okay, grand, decision made, and I haven't looked back. But you know, no one ever told me as a young person that was a thing.
I could actually see over my shoulder, "Olive" by Emma Gannon, which is an excellent book about basically celebrating wanting to be child free. And again, like that's one book that I can think of off the top of my head that I've read where that is sort of the central focus. And yeah, it's not something that's represented as often. It's certainly growing up, I think Caitlin and I both had that representation of, you know, it's not something that you choose to be happily. And so it does really impact how you think about your future. And you just sort of assume that you're going to want certain things without questioning it. And I guess, unfortunately, Sid and Mel have to question it a little bit earlier than the rest of us do, and they have to actually think about that stuff before the rest of us do.
Yeah, but that's what the problem. That's what happens. You know, they're not talked about.
Yeah,
none of this stuff is talked about. And then, you know, when you get pregnant, it's really too late at that point to start Googling this stuff and trying to figure out what you think about it. You've got a very short time window to make the most life impacting of decisions, and you're coming to it with no background information. That's just appalling.
Was there one point of view in the end that you felt drawn to more, or did you end up kind of, I guess, loving them both equally as characters to write?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I guess Sid was the one that was more fun to write because he was having a more active life and encountering more people and doing more stuff. But in the end, I think, you know, my heart was with Mel.
Damn patriarchy.
I know. Yeah. I mean, I ended up, you know, she was the one I shed tears over. But then, you know, among the minor characters, I think Lucille is the one that I identify with the most. And I keep getting people, this is Sid's mom, I keep getting people saying, you know, I really admire how you can write a really unlikable character, you know. And I'm like, what do you mean unlikable? She's basically me.
She's amazing. I love her. If anyone was unlikable, it was Nigel.
Yeah, well.
Oh, my God.
He's very unlikable. But Lucille is like, she's your worst nightmare of a mother, really, because but she's also completely relatable. Like, she's just determined to have her own life, and Sid is not going to get in the way of that. And, you know, that's fair enough, unless you're Sid, who is a 15-year-old boy who just expects her to be at his beck and call, as teenage boys do. So they have this, you know, real aggressive, hostile dynamic, which was really fun to write, actually. But she ends up being, you know, one of the wisest characters in the book and one of the most helpful. And I really, really loved her. I loved writing her. Not sure I'd want to live with her, but she's definitely one of my favourite characters. And I think if I was a parent, I'd probably be Lucille.
Yeah, I loved Lucille.
I loved her, and I loved seeing her relationship develop with Mel as well, and the way that she became that surrogate mother to Mel when Mel felt that she couldn't talk to her own parents about things just because they wouldn't entertain certain discussions. And that Lucille instead was so open to sharing her experience, getting vulnerable, and, you know, as we said, saying to her, like, I don't regret Sid as a person, but, you know, that there could have been this other path, and helping her think through those options, which, you know, is what her parents probably should have been doing. But again, as we've said, you know, you bring so much personal stuff to this debate, it's really hard to try and see those different angles when personally you're invested.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I liked about Lucille, is that she will talk about anything. And in the end, that's sort of more healthy than Mel's family. I mean, because Sid and Lucille, they look like they have this really dysfunctional relationship because they just scream at each other all the time. But later in the book, Mel kind of realizes that actually there's something healthy about that, because they will talk about anything and they'll scream at each other about anything. Whereas in her family, everybody's very polite and very nice to each other, but they don't talk about anything difficult, anything emotional, anything real. And with the result that they don't even really know what each other thinks about things, and that the possibility of an abortion becomes a real rift in her parents' marriage because they had never talked about it before and didn't know what each other thought. And, you know, and I think that was something that that I thought a lot about writing the book, because it's something that's not talked about here at all. It's quite possible that you don't know what even your nearest and dearest think about it. And I was a bit nervous about telling even my own family what I was writing about, because I didn't know how they'd react to it. And I just thought, isn't that mad that there's something like that you don't even realize? You don't know what your own family or friends think about it. But how isolating must that be if you've had an abortion or need an abortion and you don't know if you can turn to your best friend or your sister or the person sitting next to you and ask for help or ask to talk about it because you don't know what they think about it? You know, how difficult.
Yeah, you don't know what their views are. That's the thing with all these, like, big, tough, you know, topics, isn't it, is that you don't actually know what the people's around you views are. And then when things like this happen, you know, it's very different, you know, it's a very different scenario. But even in Australia, we had a referendum last year, and it was a similar thing where people were like, okay, so now we've suddenly got to talk to everyone about a really tricky topic, and you're kind of surprised what people say back to you. And that's a really tricky thing to go through. But I imagine so much not worse, what's the word? Like a really even harder conversation to have when it's not hypothetical. Like, it's actually a real situation that both their families are dealing with.
Yes, and this is what Mel found, because her debate club have a debate about abortion, and she's been in the debate club forever, and, you know, she just found it like a fun club that she goes to, and she listens to the arguments and she does her vote and all the rest. But suddenly they're debating abortion, and she's like, oh God, it's completely different when you're the person they're debating. And she's just sitting there feeling humiliated, and she's scared to say anything, and, you know, that's a completely different prospect.
Yeah, that was a really interesting scene to read about. It is interesting, though, we're talking about these things, all of these, like, big topics, and yet we have said this is obviously a young adult novel. How did you find this balance with these, like, tricky subjects not becoming too, you know, preachy on either side of the debate and get this right tone for teen readers. Because obviously also we're coming to it as adults reading it. We're not technically the intended audience. So how do you get the right tone for teenagers?
I think that the big worry when you're writing anything about an issue is that you don't want it to sound preachy, and you don't want to come across like one of their teachers or their parents, you know. And you don't want to, I don't know, you just don't want to bore them, I suppose. But yeah, with this, I mean, I was really interested in the issues because I was reading about it myself. I was just trying to educate myself and like my inner teenager who knew nothing about it. And I was thinking a lot about my teenage years while I did that. The more I read, the more the book became inevitable because I wanted there to be a book. But I wouldn't have written it. I couldn't have written it until the characters came along. It had to be about them because it would have bored me to write a book that was just about an issue. It had to be about the characters, and they were, you know,
and to find the right story to fit them.
Exactly. Yeah, they had to be real people that I really cared about. And then the story became fun to write. If I was sitting there trying to, you know, slogging my way through it, I would have known that, you know, it's not going to work. But the characters really came alive and made it fun to write, and I think that's how you know when it's working and it's going to come across as a fun read and not just a, you know, a lecture on something. But I think, you know, teenagers
yeah, that's true,
teenagers are interested in, you know, in issues and in a debate about things. I think they have this sort of natural instinct for fairness and justice, and they really care about stuff, and they're quite often outraged about stuff, and I love that about teenagers. I think we kind of lose that a bit as we get older. I really like that they get quite passionate about things, so I think they can handle a bit of a debate, and they're interested in getting something, as you say, meaty to get their teeth into. I always was at that age. I was fascinated by stuff like that, so I think you can give them lots to think about and take away and mull over.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, definitely.
Aside from, well, actually, it's not that aside from all these like big topics we're talking about, but in pretty much all young adult novels, there's all of these interesting things about the friendship dynamics, no matter how many people there are, how many perspectives the book's from or anything. And with Sid and Mel, it is an interesting friendship dynamic. Why can't I say friendship today? Friendship dynamic. As they come together in the very beginning of the book with this New Year's Eve party, where it's like both their groups of friends coming together because they wanted to spend time together. And then they all get to know each other. They're finding out the truth of it all at different rates. And I remember being struck by this bit in the middle of the novel where right after each other, one of Mel's friends is like, "You can't just ditch us all for your new boyfriend." And one of Sid's mates is texting him like, "Come out, bros before hoes, like la la la." And both of them are like, "Oh my god, we're not even preoccupied with each other, we're preoccupied with the baby," or the, you know, the pregnancy. And writing about teenagers experiencing this teen pregnancy and all of these complicated things is one thing. Writing about their friends and how they're reacting to it all, I found so fascinating as well. How did you, write a bit about that? Even, oh my gosh, like even Mel has a birthday during the book and her best friend gets her a present for the baby. It's not even for her. Which I was so heartbroken.
That was another interesting thing to think about, because there was, you know, there was the way that boys and girls experience difference differs, but then there's also that diversion between the, you know, the couple who are pregnant and all their friends who aren't, and suddenly their lives just go off in different directions. That's what really brings home to Mel and Sid kind of what they're choosing and what they're giving up. At one point Lucille is warning them about pregnancy, and she says it's really boring, you know, and that's not what they're expecting to hear. They're expecting, you know, it's hard, it's stressful, it's expensive, whatever. And she says, no, it's really boring. Then they're like, what? And that kind of brings that home to them. Their friends are all off having lives and having fun, and you're just going on as normal, and everything has changed for them. It's just like their world has completely shifted on its axis, and their focus is completely elsewhere. So that was a good way to sort of highlight, you know, what they're choosing and what they're giving up. I think that, you know, friendship at that age is so important. It's, you know, even more than when you're an adult. And that was, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to write
the book. It's literally everything, isn't it?
Yes, it is everything. And, you know, one of the things I thought about was, you know, if there was a book like this that existed for young people and someone was in that position and they'd read the book, you know, they might have some information, they might know where to go for help, you know, that'd be great. But also, if someone has read this book and something like this happens to one of their friends, that they might be able to support them a bit better. You know, because teenagers don't always go to the adults in their lives when they have a problem, but they do go to their friends. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, if one of their friends had read this book and had some information for them, could point them where to go. But even just if they knew what to say and what not to say, because I think even with the best of intentions, people can say some very insensitive things around pregnancy and abortion and unplanned pregnancy. And maybe if they'd read this and they had a little more sensitivity and could support their friends through it a bit more, because their friends, yeah, can end up being a bit insensitive about it in the book.
Something that I know that you were talking about before as well is growing up in Northern Ireland, but I'm always like curious and fascinated by what it was like for you to grow up there during the Troubles, and I guess what impact that has had on your writing overall.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. You know, it was this 30-year period of violence and sectarianism. And the thing about it was that it completely took up, you know, government completely. You know, there was very little room for anything else to happen. You know, it was all consuming. It was all about the Troubles. And it meant that when we emerged from it in the late 90s, we were just lagging behind everywhere else in lots and lots of ways. You know, we had no diversity in our population at all because no one moved here during the Troubles. Why would you come here? Our population had no diversity, and our schools were completely segregated along religious lines. Our housing was segregated along religious lines. You know, everybody was separated. And religion was this thing that was a very contentious issue, and people sort of retreated to very conservative lines, religious lines. That affected, you know, how you were taught in school and how relationship and sex education was taught in school. I mean, there was no way you were going to get a progressive RSE class in an environment like that. So I think it affected lots of things that we weren't even aware of at the time. And then, of course, you know, abortion. Abortion is one of those things that is everywhere and nowhere in Northern Ireland, you know. I mean, nobody talks about it, wasn't mentioned in school. We like to pretend it doesn't exist, that we don't have abortion here. Or we did. But at the same time, everybody knows people who have had one, or who have had an unplanned pregnancy or been denied an abortion. You know, we all know loads of stories. So I think when I came to write the book, that must have, you know, all those details have become, of true stories have become part of my thinking about it. And seeing the way those people were treated has become part of my thinking about it and part of my desire to write the book. So, you know, I think it has influenced the book in lots of ways that I'm not even aware of. I think just living here has sort of ingrained it in my subconscious in a way.
And on an even lighter note, because I know Caitlin and I are both fans of Derry Girls, was it like growing up in Derry Girls? Just to lighten the mood.
In a way, yeah. I mean, lots of those jokes in Derry Girls are funny because they're true. You know, like the bit where, you know, the bridge is blocked. It's on the news that the bridge is blocked because of there's a bomb scare or something. And everyone gathers around the TV like, oh my God. And the mum's just like, how am I going to get to the shops? You know, and they're just like, yeah, that's totally what it was like. Like if there was a bomb scare every day, but all it meant was, you know, oh, I can't go and meet my friends today. Or I remember standing in Belfast.
Because the road's blocked or something.
Because the road's blocked. Yeah, it just impacted your social life. I remember standing, and there was no mobile phones then either. So I remember standing in Belfast and I was supposed to meet my boyfriend, who's now my husband, at a certain, it was right outside the Europa Hotel in Belfast. And I'm standing on one side of a barricade, and the spot where we're supposed to meet, there's like a controlled explosion happening because there's a bomb scare. And I didn't know where he was and he didn't know where I was. And I'm just standing there kind of looking at my watch going, oh, for goodness sake, I'm supposed to be meeting my boyfriend. And would you hurry up and blow up this bomb so that we can, you know, it was just like, you were so used to it. It was just kind of an annoyance on your social life.
You know, it went on for so long as well that is kind of the point of Derry Girls, really, is that like the people, those teenagers at that point don't know any different. It's been going on their entire lives.
Exactly. Yeah, it was going on when I was born. It went on through all my teenage years. It was just normal life. And I think it's only decades later that you look back and realize, you know, what an impact it had on issues like how you were taught in school, the people you socialized with, the fact that I could not navigate my way around West Belfast to save my life because I never ever go there because I live in East Belfast and people from East and West have never really mixed, things like that. And it's only you know in your adulthood you'll suddenly stop and think, actually, that's really strange, isn't it? You know,
yeah, that's crazy. But I guess that is something joyful about Derry Girls, is that humour, that dark humour comes through of like, well, what am I going to do now? Yeah, like it just, I think that's probably why it's done so well and is so beloved and everything as well. But yeah.
Yeah, the humour is so important. And I do wonder if that's a Northern Irish thing that, you know, you know, if you didn't laugh, you'd cry, because we're very funny people. And, you know, people ask me about, you know, writing a book this heavy, you know, on a, you know, a top topic this heavy, but making it funny. And I'm like, but, you know, it had to be. Yeah. Well, the thing is, I think, you know, it wouldn't have been realistic if it wasn't funny. No one's ever convinced me of anything without making me laugh, because life is hilarious. People are hilarious. The worse things get, the more we try to make each other laugh. And that's when characters feel real to me. I think if they're not being funny, they feel cardboard to me. That's how I know they're real, is if they're being funny. And maybe that's something that we just grew up with in Northern Ireland. It was like, you just have to make a joke of everything.
Yeah. I think it's human nature. Nothing's ever that serious.
Yeah.
So then, Kelly, what has the reaction from teen readers been like so far for Little Bang?
It's been amazing, actually. I've been really, really pleased with the reaction from adults and teenagers. You know, it's something that I was a bit nervous about writing about, because I mean, it's a controversial thing and people get very emotional about it. But also, you know, it's a thing that's so silenced and stigmatized that it feels like if you get an opportunity to say something about it, you feel a real pressure to get it right and to do something useful. So I really wanted, you know, it to be valuable to teenagers. But yeah, I've had messages from people saying, you know, this took me back to my teenage years, and you know, it was quite cathartic and helped me sort of lay to rest ish things that happened and made me think about them. And I had a friend whose young daughter read it the other day, and she's quite a young teenager, she's about 13-14, and she said she found it really intense. Like, she said she thought it was maybe the first time she'd read a book where she encountered like real peril and she felt like really, really uptight and nervous for Mel, you know, because of what she was going through. Her favorite character in the book was the woman on the helpline when she, you know, phones to talk about getting an abortion. And this, you know, the character's in the book for about half a page, but she was like, she was the one who made it all okay. So that was her favorite character.
Yeah.
You do feel that. You do feel that moment.
It's incredible.
Yeah, the different reactions people have to it are really interesting. You know, when you tell people that you're writing something like this or that you've written something like this, it's amazing how many people start telling you their story, the thing that happened to them or their daughter or their sister. You know, I had loads of people come up to me during the book launch to get their book signed, and they would just sort of lean over and go, you know, this happened to me or to my daughter or whatever. And I feel so touched that people, you know, want to share that with me. But at the same time, you know, it's completely understandable because it is something that's so silenced. And who do you go to with it? Who do you talk to about it? And it feels like when there is a window, when you're given an opportunity to say something, people want to tell their stories. I think they're sick of being silenced over it. And it was the same thing after the referendum happened. You know, the floodgates opened and people started telling their stories. And, you know, those were the stories that were the most useful in my research for writing the book. It was all the personal testimonies of people who had been through it, especially traveling for abortion or being denied an abortion. You can get all the details of having an abortion from sites like the British Pregnancy Advisory Service, but what they don't give you is the emotion, what the experience is like. And those personal testimonies had all that. So they were like the most useful research I did. They were really amazing. But I think there was a real feeling that people were like, you know, we're sick of being silenced. We want to say what happened to us. The nicest feedback for me actually is when people really care about the characters. So I've had people, you know, draw artwork of the characters, stuff like teenagers making little, you know, artwork of the characters that they put on social media and stuff. And
that's cool.
Cause I get so attached to my characters, like really attached. When my first book came out, I cried like a baby the night before it came out because it felt like they were leaving home. I had actual like emptiness syndrome for fictional people. It was ridiculous. I was so attached to them, and this was the same. You know, I care about the characters so much. So if someone says, I thought the book was really clever, or, you know, it was really insightful, whatever, you know, or well written. That's really nice. But if they say I love the characters, I'm like, oh my God, that's amazing. So for readers to, you know, do little artwork and stuff of the characters is just my favorite thing ever.
Yeah, I love people best. Are so creative.
With my first book, I had a reader, a teenage reader, and she made little felt characters. She made a little felt birdie and sent it to me. She sewed it out of felt, and she made a little felt like tapestry thing with a quote from the book on it and a little character. And I was just like, oh my God, that's incredible. Wow.
Amazing. Oh, that's so cool. So as you just said about your first book, obviously Little Bang is your second book, as we said at the beginning. So now we're going to go back even further. Can you tell us a bit about your journey to publication?
So yeah, I mean, I'd always sort of written since I was like a tiny child. I wanted to write. I just loved books, loved stories, loved writing. I didn't really take it seriously because I didn't think that that was a real thing that you could actually do. I mean, and you know, another legacy of the Troubles was that nobody came here, and we were kids. I'd never met an author. We didn't have author visits at our school. No one would have come, and you know, an author wouldn't have come from England to visit us, and there just weren't a lot of writers here. So you know, it didn't occur to me that this was a real job that you could actually do as a career, but I just loved writing stories. And it wasn't until my sort of late 20s that I tried to write a longer thing, like an actual novel. And it was supposed to be for adults, but I very quickly realized that the only character in it that I was really interested in was the teenager. So it turned into a teenage novel, and I submitted that to a competition. It was there's a publisher called Chicken House, and they run a competition every year with the Times newspaper to find a children's book. So I entered that just because I'd finished the manuscript, and it ended up being shortlisted. And at this point, I hadn't told anyone that I wrote because I was a bit embarrassed because I just thought they'd pity me, you know, be like, oh God, she thinks she's going to be a writer, you know. So I hadn't told anybody, and then it got shortlisted, and I basically got outed in the Times. They published my name in the Times, and I had to tell people I'd written this book. But that got me an agent, which was incredibly lucky, because I mean, trying to find an agent is just a heartbreaking process, and I know lots of people going through it. Yeah, really hard, soul destroying in some cases. So I was really incredibly lucky that, you know, I didn't have to go through that. An agent contacted me and asked to read it, and took me on. And that book didn't get published, it didn't sell, but then the next one I wrote, she sold to Walker Books and got a 2-book deal with them. So that's how I ended up with Walker, and I'm so grateful because they're absolutely lovely to work with. I really like them.
I love the competition stories. It is not the first time that I've heard where people are like, I hadn't told anyone, and then it, you know, got shortlisted, or then it won, and it was like, oh no, and now I have to tell people, now I have to do something.
I was really nervous about telling people.
That's the amazing thing about like these writing competitions and publishing competitions, is it does, you know, it pulls people out of the woodwork, and you're like, oh, because you just go like, oh, can't hurt to enter, right?
Yeah, it's definitely worth,
who knows what could happen,
giving it a go. And I the only reason I did enter was that I was doing, and I'd gone back to university to do an English degree at the time, and there was some creative writing modules, and one of my tutors was Sinead Morrissey, who's a really well-known poet. She's from here. And you know, at that point I hadn't shown my writing to anyone, so literally the first person I ever had to show my writing to was like this really famous poet, and I was like, oh my God, no pressure. But she was so lovely, and she said, you know, you need to start sending your stuff out, and that was why I finished the manuscript and submitted it. So you know, you just need one person to kind of give you a bit of encouragement.
Yeah,
that's wonderful. Did anything change for you in the process between writing books one and two, apart from, you know, having more of a deadline for book two?
Yeah, well, actually there wasn't a huge deadline. You know, Walker are quite laid back about that sort of thing, which really suits me because I'm incredibly slow. But yeah, I think what changed was that I had to go away and learn how to write a book. You know, when I wrote Flying Tips, I had no idea what an inciting incident was, or a midpoint, or, you know, a character arc. I didn't know any of that stuff. I think it was a complete fluke that I managed to write that book and get it published. It was only the second manuscript I'd ever written. And, you know, you're supposed to write 4 or 5 rubbish books that end up in the bottom drawer before you write the one that gets published. And I just did it the other way around. I somehow managed to fluke my way into a book that got published. And then I realized I have no idea how to write another book. And I wrote, you know, 3 or 4 full manuscripts that went nowhere before I wrote Little Bang then. So I think I was just trying to figure out how to write a book in that period, and it took me quite a while.
That is an interesting story, because you're right, it is kind of the other way around. It's also nice though that yeah, you didn't have this hard deadline from your publisher, because that's another thing we hear a lot of the time as well, is like, oh, well, then it's faster because, you know, they want the book out the next year or something. And yeah, especially for people's first books, whereas when you're writing a book knowing that someone's going to publish it, it's very different.
Yeah, and I can completely understand why publishers like, you know, you to produce a book a year or whatever it is, because they've spent a lot of money on marketing and stuff, and they, you know, that's kind of wasted if then if you don't put another book out at the year after. But I wouldn't enjoy writing like that. I wouldn't enjoy that kind of schedule. I think the pressure would not make me produce anything good. So I feel really lucky that I have had the time to just figure out what I wanted to write and come up with something that I was really happy with.
I think especially when you're tackling a subject like you are in Little Bang, having the extra time is really good to make sure you do absolutely get it right, because it is an emotional and nuanced discussion. And so yeah, it's great that you had that sort of experience. Was anything sort of surprising second time round in terms of actually publishing and getting the book out? Was there anything that you were like, I know what to expect, and then it changed?
No, I think it's probably just I did know what to expect a bit more. I mean, when the first book came out, literally every email I got from my editor, I had to go and Google half the words in it because I didn't understand what they were. I didn't know what interiors were or arcs or proofs or, you know, copy edits or anything. I just didn't know anything. So this time around, I knew a bit more what to expect in that sense. But yeah, everything would have been pretty similar otherwise.
Definitely easier knowing what's going on this time around. And the other thing that we mentioned in the little introduction was that you also run a writing club for teens. Can you tell us a bit about that and I guess why you love it as well?
Yeah, I love it because it's so inspiring. Like, it's just we do it online and in person, and I run the online version, and it's just teenagers from Northern Ireland. Anyone can come, and we meet every other week. The lovely thing about it, it's run by Fighting Words Northern Ireland, so they run lots of creative writing workshops for schools. They do free creative writing workshops. They're an amazing organisation. And Write Club is their teen writing group. And the teens come along and it's just like a drop-in thing. They can come whenever they want and they can bring anything they want to work on. So it's not like we, you know, give them set exercises or prompts or anything. They just bring their own stuff. We can give them exercises and prompts if they want them. But what I find is that the majority of the time, they have their own ideas, and they're much more passionate about their own ideas than any exercise that you could give them, and they'll take their own ideas much further. We have so many of them writing whole novels that they've come up with themselves. They're so inspiring. I mean, that's what I love about it. I come away from each meeting like they put my inner teenager to shame. I'm like, my God, I was nowhere near as good a writer as you when I was your age. That's amazing. We have a girl who's on her third novel. She's about 16. It's you know, their ambition and their creativity is just really, really inspiring. And they're just lovely kids. It's really nice to hang out with people who want to write. We didn't have that when I was a kid. Like I said, you know, writers didn't come to our school. We didn't have a creative writing group. I didn't know anyone else who wrote. I didn't meet another writer till I was in my 20s. So this was, you know, working with these teenagers, it's like, my inner teenager has finally got that, gets to hang out with other teenage writers. It's really nice. They're inspiring. The things they talk about, the things they're interested in. I find all that very interesting because I'm writing about teenagers, so that's good too.
Teenagers are amazing, aren't they?
That's so wonderful and inspiring.
I think it's so good for them as well to have an outlet, you know, a creative outlet with something that we didn't have in school. And that period of your life is so major, there's so much going on, and you're figuring out not just who you are, but who, you know, what the world is and what your place in it is going to be. That's a lot to think about. And I think having a creative outlet is so important, just even for stress relief, as well as, you know, exploring new ideas and thinking about, you know, what you think about things. And, you know, we didn't have that when I was a teenager. And I think these days teenagers have even more to think about, you know, big issues, and they're bombarded by stuff on the internet that we weren't, you know, there was no internet when I was a teenager. So we didn't have, you know, we weren't doom scrolling. There wasn't all that to deal with. I would love for every high school to have a creative writing club. You know, I was a children's writing fellow at Queen's for 2 years, and my project was to set up a website that would help high schools set up creative writing clubs, because I think it's just so important for there to be that outlet for every teen.
Yeah, I love that. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. today, so early in the morning too. We've had such a blast talking to you about Sid and Mel and their journey and your journey as a writer. It's just been absolutely wonderful. And we're excited to read more of your work in the future as well.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a really lovely chat.
Could you just let people know where they can find you online, please?
Yeah, it's just kellymccochran.com. McCochran is spelt a bit weird, so you have to spell it right, but it's McCaughran. I'm on there, and I'm on Instagram and Twitter as well.
Thank you for listening to Better Words. For even more recommendations, you can subscribe to our monthly newsletter on Substack at betterwords.substack.com.
We'd also love to continue the conversation on Instagram, where you can find us at BetterWordsPod.
You can also follow me, Caitlin, at Just a Bookish Babe.
And for more bookish discussions, find me, Michelle, on Substack at theunfinishedbookshelf.substack.com.
Just like with books, podcasts like ours rely on word-of-mouth recommendations.
So if you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a book-loving friend and leave a rating or review. We'd really appreciate it.